This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk, and I'm talking to Joanna Cantor. She's the author of Alternative Remedies for Loss, her first novel. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, David.
How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, I'm really happy to be doing this. It's nice to talk in person.
Yes.
I really like doing that. So your book, as we are doing this, your book is just out.
Yes.
Right? And this is your first novel.
It is.
So, and I have to ask, how does it feel to be out in the world with your book in your hand?
It feels so crazy. I mean, this was a private project for many years. And I, of course, I always had the goal of having it be born into the world. But it's really interesting to talk about something that was only mine.
Right.
For so long.
For how long? How long did you, when did you start writing?
I started writing it in 2010. I had no plot at that point, but I was writing about these characters. And then in 2013, I really figured out the arc of the book. In 2016, I found an agent. We did some revising, sold it in 2017.
And here we are.
Yeah.
So it's a long, you know, that's a kind of solid, long gestation period.
Right.
Had you always wanted to write a novel?
I think probably when I was a little kid, I wanted to write a novel. And then it felt too intimidating for a while. And I thought maybe I would be a journalist. And I experimented with other types of writing. And then when I was in my mid-20s and moved to New York, that was when I actually took my first fiction class and said, this is really what I want to do. Yeah.
So in a way, you came to writing a little later. You know, lots of people say, I wanted to be a writer from the time I picked
up
a pencil.
Right. And I think I did, but I just wasn't sure what kind of writer, what form it would take.
Well, the novel is an interesting thing. I don't know why reading this book, we'll talk about the book too, but reading this book made me think about why you write it. Why does someone write a novel? Mm. You know, and I've taken classes in writing and fiction in particular, and I always thought that you write a novel to solve a problem on a certain level.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that, not directly, I don't mean that it's like, well, I don't know how to do this, so I'll write a book about it. But more that what drives you is the desire to understand something and to figure it out. And the story, in a lot of ways, I mean, we tell stories in order to understand.
Yeah.
And so, in a way, and this book, the reason I thought of it is, of course, the book is about a woman who's faced with a change in her life unexpectedly. Mm-hmm. We can say what this part of the book is about, that her mother dies.
Yes.
And that's the crux of the story, that begins the whole story for her.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to me to be the story, you know, that it was to understand something about loss and who your people are and where they come from and how sometimes you don't really know them.
Sometimes you don't really know them, and sometimes you don't get the chance to know them in the way that you might have wanted to as an adult.
Right. Well, in fact, maybe that's a thing about that happens for kids, that by the time we are old enough to grapple with who our parents really are, it's usually too late.
Right. Because as a kid, they're just your parents. You don't really want to think about them as so multidimensional and complicated.
You can't.
Mm-hmm.
Because because kids by nature are self-centered, and parents by nature are nurturing the self-centeredness. I mean, we try to teach children to not be,
too self-centered.
Right. You want them to be fully formed adults, but as a parent, you are focusing on your kids and what you care about. Well, this is, of course, in the fantasy world of parenting.
Perfect parents.
Right. Because it isn't that way, really.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, that's what parents are trying to do, is help their children become adults.
Right. You're not going to your children and saying, will you help me sort out my midlife crisis?
Right. In fact, that's the last thing.
That's the thing you're hopefully
Since I'm right. old enough to have been through, I can tell you that grown-up parents don't want their grown-up children to tell them how to live.
Mm-hmm.
Although, in a way, maybe they should, because, you know, kids know things that their parents can't know.
Yeah.
And parents, of course, know things their kids can't know. But a lot of it, I you know, you think about that, that, like, for instance, in my case, which it's not about me, but I found out when I was about 13 that my mother had been married before she married my father.
Oh,
it was
wow.
a total accident that we learned this, because the guy that introduced my parents to each other was having dinner at our house,
mm-hmm.
and he just mentioned it. It was like
mentioned
it just
it.
Came out of his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that guy, you know, that you married. And all three of my, both me and my two siblings were stunned. Couldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I mean, of course, in your book, without giving anything mm-hmm. away, there is a similar theme.
Right.
Not event, but theme.
Right.
And I think it's really powerful for a child to learn something that illuminates who their parents are. But a lot of times you don't find out when it will do you any good.
Right.
Or you can't ask them.
You can't
and of course,
them about it.
Even then, my mother told us almost nothing.
Mm-hmm. When you did confront
yeah.
her with this information.
From her point of view, it was like, not so much none of your business, but not germane to our lives. Right?
I remember having a similar, when I was about 10, I learned by accident that my father had had a sister who died during childhood.
Right.
And I felt really scandalized that this had been kept from me. But when I talked to him about it, he didn't have a lot to say. It was a horrible thing that happened when he was a
right.
little kid.
Well, in a way, it's like what we were talking about before we started recording, and that is that events that happen are really big when they happen.
Mm-hmm.
As time goes on, they become woven into the fabric of your
mm-hmm.
life. They're part of memory.
Mm-hmm.
They're no longer active events.
Mm-hmm.
And so for your father, that
mm-hmm.
thing that happened, by the time you found out about it, it had been kind of baked into his being.
Right, exactly.
And you and it is true. I'm sure memory has, this must have something to do with aging, that you only remember certain things.
Mm-hmm.
You don't remember everything.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember, you can construct your own story. You construct your
right.
own narrative. So your, I mean, and the way your book is written, it's a kind of narrative told in the, in you know, it's like all focused on your main character.
Right.
She is the you know, the entry point.
Mm-hmm.
And she's creating a story.
She's creating
herself.
A story about this year that
yeah.
would be very different than the story that her brothers or her father.
Right. Well, of course she won't, but she's also kind of oddly, you know, kind of wanting to protect. You know, it sounds
mm-hmm.
like she's protecting them from something, but she's really protecting herself,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, she's a really interesting character. And of course, you know, maybe you're young enough to be able to write her, you know, from close, you know, because she's 23
mm-hmm.
and she's, I think I would have trouble writing about a 20,
right.
my 23, I don't mean that you're being autobiographical, but
no.
You have to build from your own experience.
And it's interesting too, because I was 27 when I started.
Right, so you were very close.
About a 22 or 23
right.
year old.
Right.
So at that point it was much closer than it is now.
Right.
And
I think that's hard to do. I mean, what you've done is really interesting, because I mean, you know, I think there's a tendency, and this is not meaning to cap, you know, to kind of make, well, it is making a broad statement, but
okay.
Would it not be normal for you as a writer to write about the things that are most important to you at the time?
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're fairly young, you're going to be writing about the things that are vivid in your life at the
right.
time.
Right, and in your recent memory.
Right. Although I guess, you know, you could argue that some people write fiction that focuses on the things that really either bothered them or troubled them or inspired them when they were, you know, 7 or 8 years old. Not necessarily when they're, you know, 23.
Right. Because as you say, in terms of writing a novel to solve a problem, you could still be turning over the problem of being 8.
That's right.
Or 12.
Right.
And
it just depends on who you are
mm-hmm.
and what thing made the most impact on you.
Mm-hmm.
Like I read this book by Claire Massoud called The Burning Girl.
Right. I love Claire Massoud.
And it's a really amazing novel, mm-hmm. which focuses on a girl who's maybe in, early teens. But Claire is not, she's not 18 or 20,
right.
but that really was important to her.
Mm-hmm.
That something about that period.
That moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of girl becoming self-aware.
It's a really interesting, I would broadly say that 18 to 23 is kind of a period.
Right.
That it's like a late coming of age period, maybe it's fair to say.
Well, this is definitely a coming of age story.
Right. This is definitely a coming of age story, but I think I used to think a coming of age story meant 13 or 16.
Holden Caulfield.
Right, Holden Caulfield. And so we're kind of, maybe we're coming to age a little later as a culture. Maybe there's just a few different entry points into that experience.
Right. Well, no, that's an interesting point, that it may be that in modern culture, we think of kids as growing up faster.
Yeah, but I don't think that's true.
Right. They're more protected also.
Mm-hmm.
And more disallowed. They're mm-hmm. more contained.
Right. There isn't that much freedom because there's a sense that the world isn't as safe.
Right. Right. That's true. And I know people who are my age will talk about this a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And probably boringly. So that when we were 12 or 13 years old, we could ride our bikes and walk anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know you grew up in a suburban setting.
But I couldn't do that.
But you couldn't do that.
Not so much because, maybe in parts of my town you could have,
but
we lived on a busy road.
Exactly.
And it wasn't appropriate.
And I think that's a big difference between
mm-hmm.
now and 30 or 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that the world is literally more dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
It's that it is it's more crowded.
Yeah.
And there is a sense of danger. For instance, kids in New York, and again, my own experience was I used to take the train in New York
mm-hmm.
when I was 11 or 12 to go to a doctor's appointment by myself.
That's amazing.
On the train,
mm-hmm.
Then the subway or whatever. No parent in Connecticut would ever let their kid do that today. Never.
What do you think would be a normal age now? Like, I think when I was maybe 15 or 16, I started to be able to do that.
Yeah, but often mm-hmm. not by yourself.
Maybe with a friend.
Yeah, with a friend.
Yeah, you're right. Not totally.
No, but I think it's also different for girls because women are, treated differently
mm-hmm.
than men. Girls are treated differently than boys.
Yeah.
To some extent. But it's still, I think most parents are more sensitized to that and it gets passed on
mm-hmm.
to the kids. And it's kind of reinforcing what you're saying. That sense of danger
mm-hmm.
Helps you stay in a cocoon
mm-hmm.
longer.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to engage.
Yeah.
Now, that may not be true for kids who grow up on a farm, let's say.
Right.
Or who grew up, in a ranch.
Right. Or in families with many, many kids.
Right. Yeah. Where there's a bigger support system
mm-hmm.
and where you have to either work at an earlier age.
Mm-hmm.
There are certainly parts of the country and places where socially that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
But in a sort of broadly suburban
Northeast,
urban, it's there, you wouldn't find the freedom
mm-hmm.
that kids had. And maybe even 100 years ago, when they were, kids were doing things, they were growing up faster.
Mm-hmm.
And learning the lessons of the world in a different way.
Yeah.
Now they're also mediated through social media, through
mm-hmm.
television, through film, through the internet. So the mediation of experience also has an effect.
It's really different.
Yeah. Well, that's, it's changeable in a much more rapid way. So, that you're not even that young
mm-hmm.
anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So kids who are growing up today have a different experience than you did.
Because I didn't have a computer or really internet access until I was junior high. Maybe the beginning of high school was when it was becoming really, really normal. It was like America Online and all that silly stuff and
modems.
Chat rooms.
Modems.
And oh my gosh, so slow. Like I can't believe how much time we spent waiting for those systems to work. But I did have, the years under say 12 were pretty technology
Right.
Free, which is...
And no cell phone.
And social media wasn't even a thing, part of my life until well after college. Right.
So, but the characters in your book, mm-hmm. who are, you know, in their early 20s, mm-hmm. this could take place, you know, it's not set in a particular time.
No.
Modern era.
Modern-ish, maybe yeah. last five, yeah. 6 years.
So, and they're all pretty socially... connected to their phones and mm-hmm. socially driven by social media, but in the way that early adulthood operates.
Mm-hmm.
I thought there were some, you know, there was a, there is a, I guess we can talk about this, that your main character,
mm-hmm.
Olivia, does she, as part of her quest,
mm-hmm.
you know, her quest year is to go to India.
India.
And while she's there, there's a period of time when she's offline.
Right.
Because she's in an ashram.
Right.
And I thought that was, you know, you didn't make it a big deal, which I thought was good, that she just sort of accidentally realized that she couldn't connect with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that she missed out on a lot of communication
with
that
her family,
actually
yeah.
needed, should have had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she screwed up.
She screwed something up.
Yeah.
That was so fun, actually, because I think technology is a bit of a problem of fiction writing. I don't know if other people have said this to you, but it's sort of annoying to have characters always have an easy way to be in touch.
Right, because it takes away some of the drama mm-hmm. that's possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, so send them to an ashram.
Right, it gets them away
mm-hmm.
from... America and also from everything that they're connected to.
Right.
Yeah. So have you ever been to an ashram?
I've spent quite a bit of time in India and time studying yoga, but not yoga in India.
Right. And not the way that Olivia does.
Not the way that Olivia does. I did a Buddhist studies program mm-hmm. as my junior year study abroad in college. And so I was staying in a monastery, but it was a monastery that was also a guest house.
Was it in India?
It was in Bodh Gaya. It was
Northern
in Bodh Gaya, the town where I sent Olivia
yeah.
to the ashram. So I wasn't doing yoga, but I was meditating, and I was very immersed in a rural Indian life right. for about 4 months.
So that, yeah, because, that's hard to write about without having some experience.
Right. Right,
so,
and I wouldn't
yeah,
dare.
Right. Speaking of social media and the phone, when you were in India, did
mm-hmm.
you did you go to some of the the other places
mm-hmm.
that you went? You traveled on the train?
I did. I traveled on the train. I didn't go... I haven't been to some of the places that I send Olivia's family. I was mostly in the Northeast. So I was in Delhi, Calcutta, Varanasi, Sikkim, which is up in the Himalayas.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But I did have that experience of traveling, you know, 18-hour train rides.
Right.
And yeah, some of the experiences that I do give to her.
Yeah. No, it's, I think that I thought that was really well done, because as a reader, you don't feel that it's out of place. You know, you didn't have to work overly hard
to get it.
It was natural,
yeah.
which is
mm-hmm.
good. You know, you don't want to kind of have to think about it,
mm-hmm.
Like wondering if it's accurate or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was good. And, there was something else I was going to ask you about. Oh, that because you have her in this period of time pursuing a bit of learning yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And where she had been an athlete, she had not really ever done yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty funny, actually, to have her. And you didn't go for the slapstick, so that was, you know, you could have.
Right.
But you have yourself taught yoga?
Mm-hmm, I do currently.
You do now?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So do you feel like she's one of your students in that way?
Oh, that's funny. I hadn't thought about that, but she definitely could be. I mean, yeah, and I would say she was like an earlier version of me, but my entry into yoga was much slower than hers. I never just dropped into an immersive ashram with no experience, so... By the time I went on a yoga retreat, I actually wanted to be there. But yeah, she's in these poses and being like, why is this so hard? Why is this so uncomfortable? And of course, just the racing mind.
Right. Right, which is
all of which I can relate to.
Yeah, I think that's hard for anybody who has ever tried to meditate, or even people who meditate a lot. It is, because what we're doing is living daily life and then meditating. And it's not normal in a way.
Oh, interesting.
You know, you're sort of breaking, you know, it becomes a sort of disconnect. You know, it's one experience and then there's another experience.
And you try to just shift gears really quickly.
And it's really hard. And I would think this sort of relates back to the notion of, you know, they're not having social media, not having the internet, you know, like the ashram in a way, definitely makes it easier to make that transition.
Yeah.
Because you, like, if you're trying to meditate for 30 minutes and then you're going to go have a cup of coffee and race off to work.
Which I do, which right. I completely well, do.
That's
that.
What you know, yeah. people do. It there's that, again, this sort of sense that if you want to be enlightened, you have to give up everything. But we don't want to give up everything. You know, we don't want to do that.
And it's impractical.
Right. Well, it is for most people. Right. There are a few people who don't.
Who make that really their life path.
Yeah. But most people, even in India and in places where Buddhism and Hindu religion are practiced, people, there are very few people who
are really.
Yeah. They're not, that not everyone's a monk. So. But the complication is, I think, in the modern world, in the super technological modern world, the gulf between anything called a quietness and the daily life is really greater.
It's really huge, and we are expecting ourselves to toggle very quickly between those modes.
And so I think, in a way, that's a overall self-criticism of our culture, that we end up treating then... I don't mean that you do, but that sort of general treatment of yoga or meditation or mindfulness becomes a thing rather than a practice.
Right. It's like you think you can just take this vitamin and make up for the rest of your diet or your day.
Right.
We're doing that a little bit with these practices too.
But it actually does do that. You know, it actually works.
It actually does help.
Right.
But
it is like taking a pill. it's more work.
It's more work. It takes more time.
Yeah, and it's probably more legitimate. But, you know, there is an element of that, which is one view of it is, well, it's okay because it's better than not doing
right.
it. So even if you're not fully engaged, it's better than being fully disengaged.
That's something I tell myself with a lot of things, actually, right? You can't always aim for perfection.
Right. No, if you try to aim for perfection, you'll be more disappointed.
Yeah.
So you have to accept what is possible.
Right. Is it better to do this and have it not be perfect, but still get some benefit from it? And I tell my yoga students sometimes, you know, even if your mind is racing while we're in this pose and you're having no luck calming your mind today, your body is still getting the benefits of what we're doing right now. So don't worry about it.
Right.
Like, it's not being taken away from you.
Right. No, that's a good approach. But do you feel, is it true, this is something I don't know because I've never really done much yoga, that is the benefit diminished by the engagement of the mind? Isn't it, is the body and mind differential important to close in order to fully experience the physicality?
You know, I don't really know the answer to that, and I don't know if there is like a scientifically proven answer to that. All I know is that it seems better to show up and do what you can. And what every meditation teacher I've ever had has said is the meditation is the act of bringing your mind back to the present. Nobody's going to stay there all the time, but you catch yourself drifting, you come back. That's a muscle that gets strengthened over time so that maybe you're coming back more and more quickly.
Right. No, that's good.
So I just try not to think about, I try not to think about all the things that are going wrong and just say, I'm showing up. I have a lot of this time for this practice and I'm going to do my best and try to really let go of the parts that don't go perfectly. I mean, it's hard, but.
Do you feel like you could say the same thing about writing? Is, you know, the, do you have to?
I try. I mean, and writing is like the hardest thing in terms of that inner critic always saying, you're not doing it right. You were just on Instagram. This sentence is crappy. Like, and all of that is constantly going on, but I do try to apply that more meditative attitude of, you can really only control like this next moment of what your effort and your awareness are. You can't do anything to change how you just spent the last 10 minutes.
You really just can't. No, I know.
I mean, it's so obvious, but it's like, what, you know?
Yeah. Well, that if you could always do that, you'd live a life of no regrets.
Yeah.
Which is hard to do.
Just hard to do.
Right. But, and the other problem with writing is, even though you're looking for the future, I was going to ask you about revising. You know, when you've written it, you have to reread it.
Okay.
So you're not actually able to disengage from what you did. So it kind of makes it harder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when you read those sentences and you think, oh my God, I'm not getting it right.
But you know what the most reassuring thing to me about that is? There are days, which are rare, when I feel like I'm having a good writing day and I'm being really smart. And a lot of days when I feel like I'm writing like an idiot. And when I go back and reread, I can't tell the difference.
Oh, that's really interesting.
It's not actually affecting the quality of my work. It's just a mental thing.
Right. That may be the top layer of mind.
Yeah.
Where writing is really, you know, writing is a really interesting combination of interior and exterior because the words are, you know, they're the language of our daily life.
Sure.
But the inspiration for putting them into sentences is actually coming from a deeper place.
It's deeply internal.
Right. Mm-hmm. And story has to be, I mean, I don't write novels, so I can't say this for sure. And story is complicated. You know, when you're writing a big book, there's a lot going on intellectually and not, it can't all be inspiration.
No.
The pieces have to fit together. There has to be coherence.
Right.
That requires kind of the more sort structural
of left
mind.
Brain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the right brain has to always be available.
Mm-hmm. So, how do you manage your storyline when you're writing a big book?
Well, you know, of course, this was my first book, and I felt like I was really operating pretty blindly. I felt like it was a process of making a little advance in one area and then doubling back. So I would write about a character, I would get to know that character, and that would give me an idea for what needed to happen in the plot. And so then I would kind of maybe do a little rewriting to bring us up to that point in the plot. Because character and plot are so interwoven in a character-driven story. I wasn't really able to map out a plot until I had really gotten to know these characters. And then, you know, at some point I did. At some point, honestly, really about halfway through the writing process was when I finally had the whole arc in my head. And then things began to move faster. But it certainly wasn't something that I went into writing the book with, for better or worse.
Well, you know, since this is such a character-driven story, what do you feel is your relationship to the characters now that the book is done? Do they stick around? Do they have something else to tell you? Do you feel them kind of traveling with you as you're going around and talking about the book?
You know, it's funny. Somebody asked me this at an event last week or something similar, and it wasn't really something I'd thought about. I feel like I do carry them with me, but kind of in a little bit of a static way, in that I haven't really imagined them aging yet. Maybe I'll get there. You know, maybe they are the ages that they are in the book right now, since the book just came out. But I do imagine them as people, but people who are maybe only a month or two past where we leave them at the end of the book.
Well, because in a way they've done their job for you.
Right.
Yeah, they don't.
Right, but Yeah, and I've been asked, you know, if I would think of, somebody asked me about a sequel, and I do feel probably not. I love these characters, and I love to imagine a little bit more about their lives, but but I also think it's exciting to think about different and new projects.
Well, and speaking of that, you know, there's always, I think it's complicated for writers, you know, when you finish one book, you know, it's a huge amount of work, and then you go through the publication process, which is another big piece of work. And then, of course, you're out in public with this thing that has been so much a part of you for so long. Do you find that it makes it, I mean, are you able to think about a future project while you're in the middle of so much energy focused on this one?
I think I was actually thinking about it a little bit more during this phase, kind of last fall when I had finished edits. And before I got into seeing so many proofs and then doing pre-pub work, I started to have little inklings of thoughts. And then in the last 6 months, I haven't had another moment to think about them. I kind of think that that's a good thing, because having written one book and seeing how much time it takes and how committed you need to be to the characters, I want to be sure that I love the next project as much. So I don't necessarily want to rush into something. And I feel like if by next month, when I probably have some time to actually sit down, the ideas from last fall still feel interesting to me, that's a really good thing to know.
Right. And then maybe you can, right, you probably don't get to feel it until you're done with this whole public phase, it seems like.
A little. I mean, I do hear writers saying that they're already well underway on a new book by the time the previous book pubs, and I'm so impressed by that. Maybe next time that will be me. But yeah, I think I'm excited to get to that stage, but I don't feel quite there yet.
Well, I think that, you know, for me, reading this book was really, it was a pleasure to read. I think that, you know, there's a sense of the, you know, a story that carries you forward with it, has momentum, and you feel in, like you actually feel comfortable with the characters as a reader. And I'm not, you know, there are a lot of books that don't do that. You know, I'm sort of, you get thinking about danger and, you know, disaster. And, you know, I did have a little bit of that with this book. There was, I think my favorite scene, I should probably, you know, I don't think this will harm anyone else's reading, but there's a great scene where it's almost a little bit of slapstick, where Olivia gets drunk and throws up in a taxi. And mm-hmm. I thought that was fantastic. because that made me, I think I felt there most forgiving of her, more forgiving of her than at any other place in the book.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Well, it was, you know, you can't help but feel like how hard it was, you know, it was pretty evocative. And of course I just knew what was going to happen next. I'm not going to give that away, but it was really fun. And I will say, you know, this, the book, when you don't notice writing as a reader, that means the style is really good. The writing is good. You know, you want to not notice it. You want it to just carry you along. I think to me, that's a sign of a good writer. So I'd like to give you praise for that.
Thank you so much, David. That means a lot.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time and, you know, fraught with difficulties that I'll probably mention when I write this up and all the difficulties we had getting this recording to work. But I really appreciate your taking the time, because I know you're busy and you're in the middle of, you know, this launching of the book, which I think is fantastic. So thanks for doing this.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. I've been talking to Joanna Cantor about Alternative Remedies for Loss. It's her first novel.